Now, I mentioned I was going to talk to Dr. Jack Lewis, who is a neuroscientist, TV personality and author, and he's on a mission, as I said a few minutes ago, to help people understand and make the most out of their brains. It's a fascinating book. It's called Sort Your Brain Out, and he talks about topics such as how not to lose your marbles, why caffeine is good for your brain, the dangers of technology for your brain, and how to keep your brain fit. Dr. Jack Lewis, very good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us this beautiful sunny morning where we are. Is it nice where you are?
It's gorgeous, yeah. And actually, I've borrowed a bit of space at my mate's office.
Good.
And I've got a view of St. Paul's. It's unbelievable.
I hope you, with the sun shining on the spires, I hope.
That's right, man. It's beautiful.
Sounds good to me. Well, listen, I hope the brain is fit and well to take the handle this call this morning, because it's an area we know so little about, given how important it is to the body and the human system.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, sort your brain out means what exactly? What are we endeavouring to achieve here?
Well, it's basically the fact, as you pointed out, that we all have one. Every single person has a brain. It's responsible for every joy, every woe, every sight, every dream that you've ever had. And yet, most of us don't really know how it works.
Yeah.
We kind of take it for granted. There's no user manual that can help us to understand how it works so that we can get more out of it. So my co-author, Adrian Webster, and I thought we'd write a book to kind of, walk people through in a very, fast-flowing, easy-to-read fashion without being too heavy on the detail, just giving people the takeaways, what they need to know about. We all know that practice makes perfect, but why does practice make perfect? And if you understand something of the brain mechanisms of neuroplasticity, where anything that you do regularly, intensively, and keep it up for long periods of time, it actually changes your brain. It physically changes your brain. And that's why, slowly but surely, you get better at whatever it is you're practicing.
Well, that's the question I'm going to ask. I would have thought the brain controls us more than us being able to control the brain.
Well, that's a brilliant philosophical question. That's true to the extent that the part of the brain that we're aware of, the operations that we're aware of in sort of consciousness, that's a small proportion of the brain's overall processing capacity. The subconscious bits, the bits which we're not consciously aware of, that does the vast majority of the thinking for us. And all week, so let's say you're making a decision, which sandwich shall I select in the shop? Shall I go for, X, Y, or Z? You might rationalize, I'll go for this, it's healthy, or this one, but that's tastier, it's fattier, it's naughty, and I want to treat myself. But really, it's your brain, the subconscious parts of your brain, are summarizing a lifetime's experience and just feeding gut feelings into the system. It's more based on instinct that we decide, and then when we look back on our decision, that's when we come up with sort of rational arguments. Do you see what I do,
and it's leading me to my next question, which is what is the difference between the brain at work and a personality at work?
So the way I'd answer that as a neuroscientist is that as a baby, you come out and there's not really much there. There's a basic starting point of a personality. But basically what that baby experiences through infancy, through childhood, through teenage life, those experiences have a fundamental impact little by little on the structure of the brain. And then that's why every single one of our brains is different, because we've all had completely different experiences. So personality kind of evolves interactively with the interactions you have with your parents and your teachers and your peers. That starts to hone those pathways, and you start developing one type of personality over another. So I'd say that the personality sits within the sort of fabric of the brain.
So it's part of the neural story. If you take, for example, then like a kid yesterday in the States, or 2 days ago, 16 years old, goes into a school and thankfully doesn't kill them, but he does stab about 40 kids or students. Now, he was born in a hospital like a baby, like every other 16-year-old 16 years ago that day. Is his brain pre-programmed to be dark and kind of a little bit psychotic? And what I'm asking is, essentially, is the nature versus nurture. Was he naturally going to do this anyway? Or was his nurture, for his family background, informing how his brain would end up?
It's a good question and a very tough one, and I appreciate you putting me on the spot. No, it's always a mixture of nature and nurture. So basically, the nurture bit that kid, I know nothing about the story.
That's okay, but just say there's so many of them anyway in the States. God help us.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes,
I can make some guesses.
So yes.
On the nature side, there's definitely some genes which are missing, whereby the person's not predestined to become emotion. You know, their behaviour to be emotionally and callous, and therefore for them to become kind of more likely to commit acts of violence. But it doesn't predestine it, but it makes it a little bit more likely if the sort of caring structure through their childhood isn't there to provide lots of support. And so you can get people that don't have this genetic kind of mistake, if you like, where they don't have any predisposition to be violent, yet they have such a tough upbringing that they lose all of the sort of natural instincts for empathy, yeah. And then they're able to commit acts of violence because they don't feel the same guilt that someone who had developed along a more natural pathway would naturally feel, which stops most of us from doing those kind of horrible things. So I would say there's a little bit of nature sometimes. Sometimes the genes go wrong, but there's a lot more nurture.
Gotcha, okay.
And you know, if you take even schizophrenia, you can have the genetic predisposition for schizophrenia, mm-hmm. right? But if you've got a really stable, secure home life and you have no major emotional kind of traumatizing experience during the adolescent years when it's most likely to be triggered, you can have the genes but not develop schizophrenia and psychosis and delusions and all the things attached to it. So this nature-nurture thing, we can always have predispositions for all sorts of nasty things, but if you give the right environment, a supportive, emotionally nourishing environment, most people turn out just great.
It's the mad versus bad argument. Are some people born bad, do you think?
It's such a tricky
one. Or does life just throw them a bad spin on the merry-go-round?
Are people born bad? Normally, that's the psychopath. A definition of a psychopath is someone that doesn't feel empathy.
Right.
So you can't imagine how someone else is feeling in any given circumstance.
So that's a mental illness then, is it?
It's a mental illness, but my point was going to be that if some people who get to the very, very top of industry and commerce are psychopathic.
Right.
They completely lack empathy, and it enables them to make the sort of financially sensible economic decisions, which are horrible for the individuals when you're having to make half the people in your company redundant and make really hard decisions. But you don't feel empathy for those employees, and so your company makes those tough decisions and rises to the top. There are people who are psychopathic, who have psychopathic traits, yet then they will never commit acts of violence because it's just not... They'd never feel inclined to do so. The thing about the psychopathic brain is when it's in the brain of someone who does get feelings of sort of self-worth from being horrible to other people, and also sometimes these people, you know, where you or I would see a neutral expression or an angry expression or a happy expression, and we would interpret the intent and the emotion of that person well, people with psychopathy, people with emotionally callous, this unemotional callous kind of syndrome, those kids committing murders over in the States, they misinterpret a neutral facial expression as a threatening one. And so they feel like they need to defend themselves against someone who's literally just glanced at them. So, you know, they're up against it, some of these people. But just because you have psychopathic tendencies doesn't mean you're going to murder people. It just means you don't do empathy.
I understand entirely. Well, let's move to far more prosaic matters, which is to say, you know, it's a bit of an axe that I'm grinding of late, which is there's just too many gadgets and too much distraction by way of smartphones and social media and so on. And I believe it's dumbing us down. People, we're not thinking enough for ourselves. We're letting others think for us. In other words, the Google generation, if you like. And I'm guilty of it myself, so I'm not trying to be holier than thou. So is all this Googling and constant access to information good for us? Or is it making our brain lazier because we feel we can take a pill rather than go for a jog?
Right. Great question. Brilliant. There's a whole chapter in Sort Your Brain Out on exactly that. And it's one I'm very passionate about because you see these, what I call digital lemmings, kind of walking down the street, heads down over their smartphone, and they'll step out in front of a bus.
Yep.
Like, people do the most ridiculous stuff when all their attention is sucked into their device. Now, what I would say was, as you said, you know, you're guilty of maybe using your devices too much. I am too. But it's about an awareness of what you're doing to yourself. Manners at a dinner table, right? The etiquette was handed down from generations and generations on, you know, what you do and don't do. The thing about these devices, they're brand new. There's no No one has any set of self-imposed rules, or very few people actually impose any rules on how much or how little they use it. There's nothing coming from previous generations. There's no guidance from the older, wiser people because they're as new to it as everyone else. So this new generation of people who all has, you know, a smartphone in their pocket that's as powerful, if not more, than the most sophisticated computers of 10 years ago, you know, we just have to have a little think about, are we using this to the best, you know, to better our abilities, or are we its slave? The kind of way I describe it is, are you master or slave to your device?
Yeah.
If every time it pings, you reach for it, no matter whether you're having a face-to-face conversation with someone or whether you're, you know, should be paying attention on crossing a road, you're slave to your phone. And the reason is they are so cunningly devised to tease the reward pathways of the brain, to give you that instant satisfaction of ping, there's a cue, and then your habit is to reach for your phone, and then will you or won't you get a reward? Oh, I've got a message from my friend. Oh, I've got a social networking update. I'm not saying people are stupid to do it. It's perfectly natural for humans to become addicted to something that is so well designed. But if it's so addictive, you've got to make sure that you limit your use, right? Mm-hmm. So what I do is between 10 and 12, 2 and 4 every day, I am undisturbable through my smartphone. Every night I switch it on silent so that it doesn't disturb my sleep, and I put it in a different room. Because if you play on your phone, you're getting this sort of this excitement going through your brain. Mm. Or in the middle of the night, you wake up, and oh, I can't sleep. And then you play a game or you check social networking or something, and you're basically incentivizing your brain to wake up in the middle of the night.
Exactly.
It's just...
So 10 to 12, you know, you're talking my language. I totally agree with you. 10 to 12 and 2 to 4, you have what you might call a digital siesta.
Correct. Great. Wow. Why didn't I think of that and put it in the book? That's a great way of
next edition. But it's a time off scenario that you just say, that's it. I'm out. I'm actually going to deal with human beings in a human fashion that doesn't involve digital maneuvering.
Well, yes, and also that's the only way you can have sustained attention on any given task for longer than about 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Because people's smartphones go off all the time. But the thing that I really, really want people to remember is it doesn't matter whether it's a habit, a skill that you want to develop or you don't. If you do something, if you do anything... and it's a sort of double-edged sword. There's good sides of it and bad sides of it. If you want to get better at a skill, if you do it every day and you don't just do the easy levels, you actually stretch yourself and put yourself out of your comfort zone, and then you keep it up for weeks and weeks and weeks, then your brain will change to get better at performing that skill, that habit. With smartphones, quite often we're training ourselves to be infinitely distracted. So the brain's still going to change in response to how you interact with the outside world, but it doesn't necessarily give you the skills that you want. It gives you the skills of not immediately disengaging from the conversation you're having and reaching for your phone, because for some reason it's more important when it could just be Facebook saying, hey, we've got a new product for you.
Yeah,
it's really worth interrupting a conversation for something that might be as unimportant as that.
No, not remotely. Dee was on to ask, she says, I put my good watch in a safe place, quote unquote, before going on holiday last summer. I am still looking for my good watch.
Well, is she looking for advice on how to avoid that situation in the future?
Yes, yes, okay. Very much so, yeah.
In which case, people do that kind of stuff all the time. And you know why? Because our memories are very much kind of, they're nested according to the environment that we're in, the state of mind we're in. The bunch of memories that come to mind when you're in the supermarket is completely different from the bunch of memories when you're in the environment of your home. Because there's so many different sort of states of mind you can be in your home. You can be in a rush, you can be relaxed, having a lazy Sunday afternoon. It's about trying to get your mind back into the state you were when you made that decision of where the best place to hide it would be. So you have to think back to, what was I doing that weekend before I went on holiday? Was I mowing the lawn? Was I wallpapering? And you have to kind of go back into the room you're in, assume the position you're in, drink, you know, recreate the environment where you had that bright idea of putting it somewhere. Or maybe she was in a rush packing. And maybe if you get yourself all, I know it sounds bonkers, but if you get yourself really sort of a little bit stressed, a little bit anxious, quickly running around doing loads of chores, you can put your brain back into the state it was in when it had that bright idea, and then suddenly you're like, this is where it is.
Yeah. Can I ask you about the Columbo effect?
Yes, please do.
Because
Have you read the book?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've been looking at it, and there's bits of it have jumped out, and I'm going, what? But the Columbo effect intrigues me because obviously people in my generation will know who Peter Falk was and Lieutenant Columbo and everything like that. But I was intrigued by the connection between the brain and the mouth. That is to say, dentistry.
Yes.
And how that the correlation? Could you kind of talk us through that, Jack?
Sure. So Columbo, you know, the lovable, shabby detective, as we all know. Like, just one more thing. He was brilliant. And he was, I think, right up until his late 60s, he was still doing movies. He was, you know, Hollywood movies. He was on set. He was remembering his lines. He was doing really well. He was a little bit forgetful. People, you know, when they get into old age, we do naturally become a little bit more forgetful, a little bit more scatty. If you train your brain, you can delay that process. But anyway, that's another story. Mm-hmm. So he had what is called mild cognitive impairment. Perfectly normal age-related brain degeneration, which means you're functioning just fine, you're just a bit forgetful. And then what happened to him was he had a couple of really big, serious dental operations. And it's the same for any sort of major surgery, that it challenges your immune system, because your immune system has to sort of, you know, rally the troops in order to defend itself against any invading lurgies that are introduced into the body anytime you cut the skin and open up the flesh to do some kind of procedure inside. And what seems to be the case is that if the immune system is rallied for some reason, it can speed up that process of age-related cognitive decline. And so you can, basically, he descended into dementia, full-blown dementia, where he couldn't really look after himself anymore in just 6 months. Yeah. And the question was, well, had he not had those, which were actually cosmetic surgical procedures, you know, was it really worth it, given that he essentially lost his brain within 6 months? Now, there's another batch of research that suggests that if you have lots of little illnesses, you know, you get a little tooth infection, you get a sniffle, you know, if every single, you know, every fortnight you've got some different health complaint, little bug, things that are challenging your immune system, avoiding just getting those little colds can also help you to hold on to your marbles, because if your immune system is constantly having to work, diverting resources away from maintaining brain pathways, then that can also speed up the thing. So, you know, eating fresh fruit and vegetables so you've got plenty of vitamins and minerals so that your immune system can deal with illnesses swiftly, so that they don't hang around and keep the immune system bubbling along too much. So two major surgeries can cause enough of an immune impact to have a negative impact on the brain, or like, say, you know, 24 minor illnesses in any given year can also do it. Yeah. It's not to say that it's going to happen to everyone. I don't want to panic people. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, I've had three colds already this year. It's just, if for years and years and years your immune system is constantly drawing energy away from brain repairs, then the brain won't be able to reinforce those pathways and keep you firing on all cylinders.
Danielle was on to say, I can rhyme off all the kings and queens of England from primary school, but I can't remember what I did last week. My short-term memory is really bad. I forget details of holidays and special occasions. My friends and partners are always so surprised I don't remember things, and they pity me. Have you any tips on how to maintain memory?
Absolutely. So the reason she can remember all of the kings and queens is because at one point in life, sat down and remembered them. Like, use some kind of mnemonic technique.
Yeah.
Maybe it is a rhyme.
Richard of York gave battle in vain. There's the rainbow.
Something like that. If anything that we want to remember, that we really want to remember, because perhaps it's embarrassing that you forgot that you were at a certain thing, if you just do those memory tricks, that, you know, they've been around since Roman and ancient Greek times. If you actually sit down and use your imagination to implant those memories in, there's the memory palace where you walk around a room that you're, or sorry, a house that you know really, really well, your house, a relative's house, it could be a shopping mall or something. And you can leave distinctive visual memories of that will trigger the memory of where I was last week. You wouldn't want to do it for everything you do every week, but if you use these memory strategies, it's about putting the effort in to using the memory in such a way that you kind of leave flags to make it easier to recall. So you're not, in that situation, you're not able to rely so much on your natural ability to just bring things to mind. You need strategies of fixing things in memory so that you can sort of follow the trail of breadcrumbs back to those memories.
Stephen in Carlow says, I witnessed a female human lemming. They enjoyed that, Jack, in Carlow yesterday in Ireland. She was texting, pushing a buggy, and had a small child walking beside her. And then she crossed the road metres away from me without looking either way, and she kept on texting all this time with Stephen in Carlow. And you know something?
That's awful, because digital lemmings, if they wipe themselves off the planet, that's one thing, but not your kids.
There you go. And there was a great cartoon in the New Yorker magazine, which I cut out because I just thought it was a sign of our times, which was a bunch of people walking through the streets of New York with canes for blind people in their hands, in their right hand, and they had their heads down in a phone in the other. Isn't that brilliant?
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. But all it is a warning. It's perfectly natural that we've all done this. I just think if society just started talking about it a bit more, as you're encouraging them to do, and just think, what's sensible, what's logical, and what's plain stupid? Yeah. I'm not saying I'm going to impose rules on people. People should find some rules and impose them on themselves so that their brain changes in a way that helps them rather than leaves them splattered on a tarmac. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. It makes a lot of sense. By the way, it's a text in, possibly from a psychic, says the good watch is in a winter coat in an unused wardrobe. That probably makes a lot of sense. We've got to leave it there. Dr. Jack Lewis, congratulations on the book. It's like a pocket-sized guide to how best to use your brain.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. We'll talk to you again, no doubt. Take care of yourself.
Brilliant interview. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you so much.